The smell of brandy rose up strong and heady, and the torch flared brighter as the fumes of alcohol reached it. Ian bucked and kicked, making a strained noise of protest, and she kicked him sharply in the ribs. "Be still," she said. "Don't do it, Geely," I said, knowing that words would do no good. "I have to," she said calmly. "I meant to. I'm sorry. I shall have to take the girl, but I'll leave you the man."
"What girl?"
Jamie's fists were clenched tight at his side, knuckles white, even in the dim torchlight.
"Brianna, that's the name, isn't it?"
She shook back her heavy hair, smoothing it out of her face. "The last of Lovett's line?" She smiled at me. "What luck you should have come to see me, eh? I'd never have kent it otherwise. I thought they'd all died out before 1900. A thrill of horror shot through me. I could feel the same tremor run through Jamie as his muscles tightened. It must have shown on his face. Geely cried out sharply and leapt back. She fired as he lunged at her. His head snapped back and his body twisted, hands still reaching for her throat. Then he fell, his body limp across the edge of the glittering pentagram. There was a strangled moan from Ian. I felt, rather than heard, a sound rise in my throat. I didn't know what I had said, but Geely turned her face in my direction, startled. When Brianna was two, a car had carelessly sideswiped mine, hitting the back door next to her where she was sitting. I slowed to a stop, checked briefly to see that she was unhurt, and then bounded out, headed for the other car, which had pulled over a little way ahead. The other driver was a man in his 30s, quite large, and probably entirely self-assured in his dealings with the world. He looked over his shoulder, saw me coming, and hastily rolled up his window, shrinking back in his seat. I had no consciousness of rage or any other emotion. I simply knew, with no shadow of doubt, that I could, and would, shatter the window with my hand and drag the man out through it. He knew it too. I thought no further than that, didn't have to. The arrival of a police car had recalled me to my normal state of mind, and then I started to shake. But the memory of the look on that man's face stayed with me. Fire is a poor illuminator, but it would have taken total darkness to conceal that look on Geely's face, the sudden realization of what was coming toward her. She jerked the other pistol from her belt and swung it to bear on me. I saw the round hole of the muzzle clearly and didn't care. The roar of the discharge caromed through the cave, the echoes sending down showers of rocks and dirt. But by then I had seized the axe from the floor. I noted quite clearly the leather binding, ornamented with a beaded pattern. It was red, with yellow zigzags and black dots. The dots echoed the shiny obsidian of the blade, and the red and yellow picked up the hues of the flaming torch behind her. I heard a noise behind me, but didn't turn. Reflections of the fire burned red in the pupils of her eyes. The red thing, Jamie had called it. I gave myself to it, he had said. I didn't need to give myself. It had taken me. There was no fear, no rage, no doubt. Only the stroke of the swinging axe. The shock of it echoed up my arm and I let go, my fingers numbed. I stood quite still, not even moving when she staggered toward me. Blood in firelight is black, not red. She took one blind step forward and fell, all her muscles gone limp, making no attempt to save herself. The last I saw of her face was her eyes, set wide, beautiful as gemstones, a green water clear and faceted with the knowledge of death. Someone was speaking, but the words made no sense. The cleft in the rock buzzed loudly, filling my ears. The torch flickered, flaring sudden yellow in a draught. The beating of the Dark Angel's wings, I thought. The sound came again, behind me. I turned and saw Jamie. He had risen to his knees, swaying. Blood was pouring from his scalp, dyeing one side of his face red-black. The other side was white as a harlequin's mask.
Stop the bleeding, said some remnant of instinct in my brain, and I fumbled for a handkerchief. But by then he had crawled to where Ian lay and was groping at the boy's bonds, jerking loose the leather straps, drops of his blood pattering on the lad's shirt. Ian squirmed to his feet, his face ghastly pale, and put out a hand to help his uncle. Then Jamie's hand was on my arm. I looked up, numbly offering the cloth. He took it and wiped it roughly over his face, then jerked at my arm, pulling me toward the tunnel mouth. I stumbled and nearly fell, caught myself, and came back to the present.
Come, he was saying. Can you not hear the wind? There is a storm coming above.
Wind, I thought, in a cave. But he was right. The draught hadn't been my imagination. The faint exhalation from the crack near the entrance had changed to a steady, whining wind, almost a keening that rang in the narrow passage. I turned to look over my shoulder, but Jamie grasped my arm hard and pushed me forward. My last sight of the cave was a blurred impression of jet and rubies, with a still white shape in the middle of the floor. Then the draught came in with a roar, and the torch went out.
Jesus!
It was young Ian's voice, filled with terror somewhere close by. Uncle Jamie!
Here!
Jamie's voice came out of the darkness just in front of me, surprisingly calm, raised to be heard above the noise.
Here, lad. Come here to me, Ian. Dinna be afraid. It's only the cave breathing.
It was the wrong thing to say. When he said it, I could feel the cold breath of the rock touch my neck, and the hairs there rose up, prickling. The image of the cave as a living thing, breathing all around us, blind and malevolent, struck me cold with horror. Apparently the notion was as terrifying to Ian as it was to me, for I heard a faint gasp, and then his groping hand struck me and clung for dear life to my arm. I clutched his hand with one of mine and probed the dark ahead with the other, finding Jamie's reassuringly large shape almost at once. "I've got Ian," I said. "For God's sake, let us get out of here." He gripped my hand in answer, and linked together, we began to make our way back down the winding tunnel, stumbling through the pitch dark and stepping on each other's heels. And all the time that ghostly wind whined at our backs. I could see nothing. No hint of Jamie's shirt in front of my face, snowy white as I knew it to be. Not even a flicker of the movement of my own light-coloured skirts, though I heard them swish about my feet as I walked, the sound blending with that of the wind. The thin rush of air rose and fell in pitch, whispering and wailing. I tried to force my mind away from the memory of what lay behind us, away from the morbid fancy that the wind held sighing voices, whispering secrets just past hearing.
"I can hear her,"
Ian said suddenly behind me. His voice rose, cracking with panic.
"I can hear her. God! Oh, God, she's coming!"
I froze in my tracks, a scream wedged in my throat. The cool observer in my head knew quite well it wasn't so, only the wind and Ian's fright. But that made no difference to the spurt of sheer terror that rose from the pit of my stomach and turned my bowels to water. I knew she was coming, too, and screamed out loud. Then Jamie had me and Ian, too, gripped tight against him, one in each arm, our ears muffled against his chest. He smelled of pine smoke and sweat and brandy, and I nearly sobbed in relief at the closeness of him.
"Hush," he said fiercely. "Hush, the both of you. I will not let her touch you. Never."
He pressed us to him hard. I felt his heart beating fast beneath my cheek, and Ian's bony shoulder squeezed against mine, and then the pressure relaxed.
"Come along now," Jamie said, more quietly. "It's but wind. Caves blow through their cracks when the weather changes above ground. I've heard it before. There is a storm coming, outside. Come now."
The storm was a brief one. By the time we had stumbled to the surface, blinking against the shock of sunlight,
The rain had passed, leaving the world reborn in its wake. Lawrence was sheltering under a dripping palm near the cave's entrance. When he saw us, he sprang to his feet, a look of relief relaxing the creases of his face.
"It is all right," he said, looking from me to a blood-stained Jamie.
Jamie gave him half a smile, nodding.
"It's all right," he said.
He turned and motioned to Ian.
"May I present my nephew, Ian Murray? Ian, this is Dr. Stern, who's been of great assistance to us in looking for you."
"I'm much obliged to you, Doctor," Ian said with a bob of his head.
He wiped a sleeve across his streaked face and glanced at Jamie.
"I knew you'd come, Uncle Jamie," he said with a tremulous smile. "But you left it a bit late, aye?"
The smile widened, then broke, and he began to tremble. He blinked hard, fighting back tears.
"I did then, and I'm sorry, Ian. Come here, Avalach."
Jamie reached out and took him in a close embrace, patting his back and murmuring to him in Gaelic.
I watched for a moment before I realised that Lawrence was speaking to me. "Are you quite well, Mrs. Fraser?" he was asking.
Without waiting for an answer, he took my arm.
"I don't quite know."
I felt completely empty, exhausted as though by childbirth, but without the exaltation of spirit. Nothing seemed quite real. Jamie, Ian, Lawrence, all seemed like toy figures that moved and talked at a distance, making noises that I had to strain to understand.
"I think perhaps we should leave this place," Lawrence said,
with a glance at the cave mouth from which we had just emerged. He looked slightly uneasy. He didn't ask about Mrs. Abernathy.
"I think you're right."
The picture of the cave we had left was vivid in my mind, but just as unreal as the vivid green jungle and grey stones around us. Not waiting for the men to follow, I turned and walked away. The feeling of remoteness increased as we walked. I felt like an automaton, built around an iron core, walking by clockwork. I followed Jamie's broad back through branches and clearings, shadow and sun, not noticing where we were going. Sweat ran down my sides and into my eyes, but I barely stirred to wipe it away. At length, toward sunset, we stopped in a small clearing near a stream and made our primitive camp. I had already discovered that Lawrence was a most useful person to have along on a camping trip. He wasn't only as good at finding or building shelter as was Jamie, but was sufficiently familiar with the flora and fauna of the area to be able to plunge into the jungle and return within half an hour bearing handfuls of edible roots, fungi, and fruit with which to augment the Spartan rations in our packs. Ian was set to gather firewood while Lawrence foraged, and I sat Jamie down with a pan of water to tend the damage to his head. I washed away the blood from face and hair, to find to my surprise that the ball had in fact not ploughed a furrow through his scalp as I had thought. Instead, it had pierced the skin just above his hairline and, evidently, vanished into his head. There was no sign of an exit wound. Unnerved by this, I prodded his scalp with increasing agitation until a sudden cry from the patient announced that I had discovered the bullet. There was a large, tender lump on the back of his head. The pistol ball had travelled under the skin, skimming the curve of his skull, and come to rest just over his occiput.
"Jesus H. Christ!" I exclaimed.
I felt it again, unbelieving, but there it was.
"You always said your head was solid bone, and I'll be damned if you weren't right. She shot you point blank, and the bloody ball bounced off your skull."
Jamie, supporting his head in his hands as I examined him, made a sound somewhere between a snort and a groan.
"Aye, well," he said,
his voice somewhat muffled in his hands.
"I'll no say I'm not thick-headed, but if Mistress Abernathy had used a full charge of powder, it wouldn't have been nearly thick enough."
"Does it hurt a lot?"
"Not the wound, no, though it's sore.
I've a terrible headache, though.
I shouldn't wonder. Hold on a bit. I'm going to take the ball out.
Not knowing in what condition we might find Ian, I had brought the smallest of my medical boxes, which fortunately contained a bottle of alcohol and a small scalpel. I shaved away a little of Jamie's abundant mane, just below the swelling, and soused the area with alcohol for disinfection. My fingers were chilled from the alcohol, but his head was warm and comfortingly live to the touch.
3 deep breaths and hold on tight, I murmured. I'm going to cut you, but it will be fast.
All right.
The back of his neck looked a little pale, but the pulse was steady. He obligingly drew in his breath deeply and exhaled, sighing. I held the area of scalp taut between the index and third fingers of my left hand. On the third breath, I said, "Right now," and drew the blade hard and quick across the scalp. He grunted slightly, but didn't cry out. I pressed gently with my right thumb against the swelling, slightly harder, and the ball popped out of the incision I had made, falling into my left hand like a grape.
"Got it," I said, and only then realized that I'd been holding my breath. I dropped the little pellet, somewhat flattened by its contact with his skull, into his hand, and smiled a little shakily.
"Souvenir," I said.
I pressed a pad of cloth against the small wound, wound a strip of cloth round his head to hold it, and then, quite suddenly, with no warning whatever, began to cry. I could feel the tears rolling down my face and my shoulders shaking, but I still felt detached, somehow outside my body. I was conscious mostly of a mild amazement.
"Sassenach, are you all right?"
Jamie was peering up at me, eyes worried under the rakish bandage.
"Yes," I said, stuttering from the force of my crying. I don't know why I'm crying. I don't know."
"Come here."
He took my hand and drew me down onto his knee. He wrapped his arms around me and held me tight, resting his cheek on the top of my head.
"It'll be all right," he whispered. "It's fine now, Mukria. It's fine."
He rocked me gently, one hand stroking my hair and neck, and murmured small unimportant things in my ear. Just as suddenly as I had been detached, I was back inside my body, warm and shaking, feeling the iron core dissolve in my tears. Gradually, I stopped weeping and lay still against his chest, hiccuping now and then, feeling nothing but peace and the comfort of his presence. I was dimly aware that Lawrence and Ian had returned, but paid no attention to them. At one point, I heard Ian say, with more curiosity than alarm,
"You're bleeding all down the back of your neck, Uncle Jamie."
"Perhaps you'll fix me a new bandage then, Ian," Jamie said.
His voice was soft and unconcerned.
"I must just hold your auntie now."
And some time later, I went to sleep, still held tight in the circle of his arms. I woke up later, curled on a blanket next to Jamie. He was leaning against a tree, one hand resting on my shoulder. He felt me wake and squeezed gently. It was dark, and I could hear a rhythmic snoring sound somewhere close at hand. It must be Lawrence, I thought drowsily, for I could hear young Ian's voice on the other side of Jamie.
"No," he was saying slowly, "it wasn't really so bad on the ship. We were all kept together, so there was company from the other lads, and they fed us decently, and let us out 2 at a time to walk about the deck. Of course we were all scared, for we'd no notion why we'd been taken, and none of the sailors would tell us anything, but we were not mistreated."
The Bruja had sailed up the Yala's river and delivered her human cargo directly to Rose Hall. Here the bewildered boys had been warmly welcomed by Mrs. Abernathy, and promptly popped into a new prison. The basement beneath the sugar mill had been fitted up comfortably enough, with beds and chamber pots, and aside from the noise of the sugar-making above during the days, it was comfortable enough. Still, none of the boys could think why they were there, though any number of suggestions were made, each more improbable than the last. and every now and then a great black fellow would come down into the place with Mrs. Abernathy. We always begged to know what it was we were there for, and would she not be letting us go for mercy's sake? But she only smiled and patted us and said we would see in good time. Then she would choose a lad, and the black fellow would clamp onto the lad's arm and take him away with him. Ian's voice sounded distressed, and little wonder.
Did the lads come back again?
Jamie asked. His hand patted me softly, and I reached up and pressed it. No, or not usually. And that scared us all something dreadful.
Ian's turn had come 8 weeks after his arrival. Three lads had gone, and not returned by then, and when Mistress Abernathy's bright green eyes rested on him, he was not disposed to cooperate.
I kicked the black fellow and hit him. I even bit his hand, Ian said ruefully. And very nasty he tasted too, all over some kind of grease he was. But it made no difference. He only clouted me over the head, hard enough to make my ears ring, then picked me up and carried me off in his arms as though I was no more than a wee bairn.
Ian had been taken into the kitchen, where he was stripped, bathed, dressed in a clean shirt, but nothing else, and taken to the main house.
It was just at night, he said wistfully, and all the windows lighted. It looked very much like Lallybroch when you come down from the hills just at dark, and Mam's just lit the lamps. It almost broke my heart to see it and think of home.
He had had little opportunity to feel homesick, though. Hercules, or Atlas, had marched him up the stairs into what was obviously Mistress Abernathy's bedroom. Mrs. Abernathy was waiting for him, dressed in a soft, loose sort of gown with odd-looking figures embroidered round the hem of it in red and silver thread. She had been cordial and welcoming, and had offered him a drink. It smelled strange, but not nasty, and as he had little choice in the matter, he had drunk it. There were two comfortable chairs in the room, on either side of a long, low table, and a great bed at one side, swagged and canopied like a king's. He had sat in one chair, Mrs. Abernathy in the other, and she had asked him questions.
"What sorts of questions?"
Jamie asked, prompting as Ian seemed hesitant.
"Well, all about my home and my family. She asked the names of all my sisters and brothers and my aunts and uncles."
I jerked a bit. So that was why Geely had betrayed no surprise at our appearance.
"And all sorts of things, Uncle. Then she asked me had I ever lain wi' a lassie? Just as though she were asking did I have parritch to my breakfast?"
Ian sounded shocked at the memory.
I didn't want to answer her, but I couldn't seem to help myself. I felt very warm, like I was fevered, and I couldn't seem to move easy. But I answered all her questions, and her just sitting there, pleasant as might be, watching me close with those big green eyes.
So you told her the truth?
Aye, I did. Ian spoke slowly, reliving the scene. I said I had, and I told her about Edinburgh and the print shop and the seamen and the brothel and Mary and everything.
For the first time, Geely had seemed displeased with one of his answers. Her face had grown hard and her eyes narrowed, and for a moment Ian was seriously afraid. He would have run then, but for the heaviness in his limbs and the presence of the giant who stood against the door, unmoving.
She got up and stamped about a bit, and said I was ruined then, as I wasn't a virgin. And what business did a bitty wee lad like me have to be going wi' the lasses and spoiling myself?
Then she had stopped her ranting, poured a glass of wine and drank it off, and her temper had seemed to cool.
She laughed then, and looked at me careful, and said as how I might not be such a loss after all. If I was no good for what she had in mind, perhaps I might have other uses.
Ian's voice sounded faintly constricted, as though his collar were too tight. Jamie made a soothing, interrogatory sound, though, and he took a deep breath, determined to go on.
Well, she
She took my hand and made me stand up. Then she took off the shirt I was wearing and she... I swear it's true, Uncle. She knelt on the floor in front of me. I took my cock into her mouth.
Jamie's hand tightened on my shoulder, but his voice betrayed no more than a mild interest.
Aye, I believe you, Ian. She made love to you, then.
Love?
Ian sounded dazed.
No, I mean, I dinna ken. She
got my cock to stand up, and then she made me come to the bed and lie down, and she did things. But it wasn't at all like it was with me, Mary.
No, I shouldn't suppose it was,
his uncle said dryly.
God, it felt queer.
I could sense Ian shudder from the tone of his voice.
I looked up in the middle, and there was the black man standing right by the bed holding a candlestick. She told him to lift it higher so that she could see better.
He paused, and I heard a small glugging noise as he drank from one of the bottles. He let out a long, quivering breath.
Uncle, have you ever lain with a woman when you didn't want to do it?
Jamie hesitated a moment, his hand tight on my shoulder, but then he said quietly,
Aye, Ian, I have.
Oh.
The boy was quiet, and I heard him scratch his head.
Do you ken how it can be, Uncle? How you can do it and not want to a bit and hate doing it and... still it feels good.
Jamie gave a small, dry laugh.
Well, what it comes to, Ian, is that your cock hasn't got a conscience and you have.
His hand left my shoulder as he turned toward his nephew.
Dinna trouble yourself, Ian, he said. You couldna help it, and it's likely that it saved your life for you. The other lads, the ones who didna come back to the cellar, d'ye ken if they were virgins?
Well, a few I know were for sure, for we had a great deal of time to talk, aye? And after a time we kent a lot about one another. Some of the lads boasted of having gone wi' a lassie, but I thought, from what they said about it again, they hadna done it really.
He paused for a moment, as though reluctant to ask what he knew he must.
Uncle, do you ken what happened to them? The rest of the lads with me?
No, Ian, Jamie said evenly. I've no notion.
He leaned back against the tree, sighing deeply.
Do you think you can sleep wi' Ian? If you can, you should, for it'll be a weary walk to the shore tomorrow.
Oh, I can sleep, Uncle, Ian assured him. But should I not keep watch? It's you should be resting after being shot and all that.
He paused, and then added rather shyly,
I didn't say thank you, Uncle Jamie.
Jamie laughed freely this time.
You're very welcome, Ian, he said, a smile still in his voice. Lay your head and sleep, laddie. I'll wake you if there's need.
Ian obligingly curled up, and within moments was breathing heavily. Jamie sighed and leaned back against the tree.
Do you want to sleep too, Jamie?
I pushed myself up to sit beside him. I'm awake. I can keep an eye out. His eyes were closed, the dying firelight dancing on the lids. He smiled without opening them and groped for my hand.
No. If you dinna mind sitting with me for a bit, though, you can watch. The headache's better if I close my eyes.
We sat in contented silence for some time, hand in hand. An occasional odd noise or far-off scream from some jungle animal came from the dark, but nothing seemed threatening now.
Will we go back to Jamaica?
I asked at last.
For Fergus and Masali.
Jamie started to shake his head, then stopped with a stifled groan.
No, he said. I think we shall sail for Eleuthera. That's Dutch-owned and neutral. We can send Innes back wi' John's booty, and he can take a message to Fergus to come and join us. I would as soon not set foot on Jamaica again, all things considered.
No, I suppose not.
I was quiet for a moment, then said, I wonder how Mr. Willoughby, will manage.
I don't suppose anyone will find him if he stays in the mountains, but...
Oh, he may manage Brawley, Jamie interrupted. He's the pelican to fish for him, after all.
One side of his mouth turned up in a smile.
For that matter, if he's canny, he'll find a way south to Martinique. There's a small colony there of Chinese traders. I'd told him of it, said I'd take him there once our business on Jamaica was finished.
You aren't angry at him now? I looked at him curiously, but his face was smooth and peaceful, almost unlined in the firelight.
This time he was careful not to move his head, but lifted one shoulder in a shrug and grimaced. Oh, no.
He sighed and settled himself more comfortably.
I dinna suppose he had much thought for what he did, or understood at all what might be the end of it. And it would be foolish to hate a man for not giving you something he hasna got in the first place.
He opened his eyes then with a faint smile, and I knew he was thinking of John Gray.
Ian twitched in his sleep, snorted loudly, and rolled over onto his back, arms flung wide.
Jamie glanced at his nephew, and the smile grew wider.
Thank God, he said. He goes back to his mother by the first ship headed for Scotland.
I don't know, I said, smiling. He might not want to go back to Lallybroch after all this adventure.
I dinna care whether he wants to or not, Jamie said firmly. He's going, if I must pack him up in a crate.
Are you looking for something, Sassenach?
He added, seeing me groping in the dark.
I've got it, I said, pulling the flat hypodermic case out of my pocket.
I flipped it open to check the contents, squinting to see by the waning light.
Oh, good. There's enough left for one whopping dose.
Jamie sat up a little straighter.
I'm not fevered a bit, he said, eyeing me warily. And if you have it in mind to shove that filthy spike into my head, you can just think again, Sassenach.
Not you, I said. Ian. Unless you mean to send him home to Jenny, riddled with syphilis and other interesting forms of the clap.
Jamie's eyebrows rose toward his hairline, and he winced at the resultant sensation.
Ow! Syphilis? You think so? I shouldn't be a bit surprised. Pronounced dementia is one of the symptoms of the advanced disease, though I must say it would be hard to tell in her case. Still, better safe than sorry, hmm?
Jamie snorted briefly with amusement.
Well, that may teach young Ian the price of dalliance. I'd best distract Stern while you take the lad behind a bush for his penance, though. Lawrence is a bonny man for a Jew, but he's curious. I dinna want you burnt at the stake in Kingston, after all.
I expect that would be awkward for the governor, I said dryly, much as he might enjoy it personally.
I shouldna think he would, Sassenach.
His dryness matched my own.
Is my coat within reach?
Yes. I found the garment folded on the ground near me and handed it to him. Are you cold?
No.
He leaned back, the coat laid across his knees.
It's only that I wanted to feel the bairns all close to me while I sleep.
He smiled at me, folded his hands gently atop the coat and its pictures, and closed his eyes again.
Good night, Sassenach.
This ends Disc 35. Voyager, Disc 36.
Chapter 63. Out of the Depths. In the morning, buoyed by rest and a breakfast of biscuit and plantain, we pressed on toward the shore in good heart. Even Ian, who ceased to limp ostentatiously after the first quarter mile. As we came down the defile that led onto the beach, though, a remarkable sight met our eyes.
"Jesus God, it's them!" Ian blurted. "The pirates!"
He turned, ready to flee back into the hills, but Jamie grasped him by the arm.
"Not pirates," he said. "It's the slaves. Luke!"
Unskilled in the seamanship of large vessels, The escaped slaves of the Yala's River plantations had evidently made a slow and blundering passage toward Hispaniola, and having somehow arrived at that island, had promptly run the ship aground. The Bruja lay canted on her side in the shallows, her keel sunk deep in the sandy mud. A very agitated group of slaves surrounded her, some rushing up and down the beach, shouting, others dashing off toward the refuge of the jungle, a few remaining to help the last of their number off the beached hulk. A quick glance out to sea showed the cause of their agitation. A patch of white showed on the horizon, growing in size even as we watched. "A man of war," Lawrence said, sounding interested. Jamie said something under his breath in Gaelic, and Ian glanced at him, shocked.
"Out of here," Jamie said tersely.
He pulled Ian about and gave him a shove up the defile, then grabbed my hand.
"Wait," said Lawrence, shading his eyes. "There's another ship coming. A little one."
The governor of Jamaica's private pinnace, to be exact, leaning at a perilous angle as she shot round the curve of the bay, her canvas bellied by the wind on her quarter. Jamie stood for a split second weighing the possibilities, then grabbed my hand again.
"Let's go," he said.
By the time we reached the edge of the beach, the pinnace's small boat was ploughing through the shallows, Rayburn and MacLeod pulling hard at the oars. I was wheezing and gulping air, my knees rubbery from the run. Jamie snatched me up bodily into his arms and ran into the surf, followed by Lawrence and Ian, gasping like whales. I saw Gordon, 100 yards out in the pinnace's bow, aim a gun at the shore and knew we were followed. The musket discharged with a puff of smoke, and Meldrum, behind him, promptly raised his own weapon and fired. Taking in turns, the two of them covered our splashing advance until friendly hands could pull us over the side and raise the boat.
"Come about," Innes, manning the wheel, barked the order, and the boom swung across, the sails filling at once.
Jamie hauled me to my feet and deposited me on a bench, then flung himself down beside me, panting.
"Holy God," he wheezed. "Did I no tell you to stay away, Duncan?" "Save your breath, MacDo," Innes said, a wide grin spreading under his moustache. "You haven't enough to be wasting it."
He shouted something to MacLeod, who nodded and did something to the lines. The pinnace heeled over, changed her course, and came about, heading straight out of the tiny cove and straight toward the man o' war, now close enough for me to see the fat-lipped porpoise grinning beneath its bowsprit. MacLeod bellowed something in Gaelic, accompanied by a gesture that left the meaning of what he had said in no doubt. To a triumphant yodel from Innes, we shot past the porpoise directly under her bow and close enough to see surprised-looking heads poking out from the rail above. I looked back as we left the cove to see the porpoise still heading in, massive under her 3 great masts. The pinnace could never outrace her on the open sea, but in close quarters the little sloop was light and manoeuvrable as a feather by comparison to the Leviathan man-o'-war.
"It's the slave ship they'll be after,"
Meldrum said, turning to look alongside me.
"We saw the man-o'-war pick her up 3 miles off the island. We thought whilst they were otherwise occupied, we might as well nip in and pick ye all off the beach."
"Good enough," Jamie said with a smile. His chest was still heaving, but he had recovered his breath.
"I hope the porpoise will be sufficiently occupied for the time being."
A warning shout from Rayburn indicated that this was not to be, however. Looking back, I could see the gleam of brass on the porpoise's deck as the pair of long guns called stern chasers were uncovered and began their process of aiming. Now, it was us at gunpoint, and I found the sensation very objectionable. Still, we were moving, and fast at that. Innes put the wheel hard over, then hard again, tacking a zigzag path past the headland. The stern chasers boomed together. There was a splash off the port bow, 20 yards away, but a good deal too close for comfort, given the fact that a 24-pound ball through the floor of the pinnace would sink us like a rock. Innes cursed and hunched his shoulders over the wheel, his missing arm giving him an odd lopsided appearance.
Our course became still more erratic, and the next three tries came nowhere near. Then came a louder boom, and I looked back to see the side of the canted Bruja erupt in splinters as the Porpoise came in range and trained her forward guns on the grounded ship. A rain of grape shot hit the beach, striking dead in the centre of a group of fleeing slaves. Bodies, and parts of bodies, flew into the air like black stick figures and fell to the sand, staining it with red blotches. Severed limbs were scattered over the beach like driftwood.
"Holy Mary, Mother of God!"
Ian, white to the lips, crossed himself, staring in horror at the beach as the shelling went on. Two more shots struck the Bruja, opening up a great hole in her side. Several landed harmlessly in the sand, and two more found their mark among the fleeing people. Then we were round the edge of the headland and heading into the open sea, the beach and its carnage lost to view.
"Pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death."
Ian finished his prayer in a whisper and crossed himself again. There was little conversation in the boat, beyond Jamie's giving Innes instructions for Eleuthera, and a conference between Innes and MacLeod as to the proper heading. The rest of us were too appalled by what we had just seen, and too relieved at our own escape, to want to talk. The weather was fair, with a bright, brisk breeze, and we made good way. By sundown, the island of Hispaniola had dropped below the horizon, and Grand Turk Island was rising to the left. I ate my small share of the available biscuit, drank a cup of water, and curled myself in the bottom of the boat, lying down between Ian and Jamie to sleep. Innes, yawning, took his own rest in the bow, while MacLeod and Meldrum took it in turns to man the helm through the night. A shout woke me in the morning. I rose on one elbow, blinking with sleep and stiff from a night spent on bare, damp boards. Jamie was standing by me, his hair blowing back in the morning breeze. "What?" I asked Jamie. "What is it?"
"I didn't believe it," he said, staring aft over the rail. "It's that bloody boat again."
I scrambled to my feet to find that it was true. Far astern were tiny white sails.
"Are you sure?"
I said, squinting.
"Can you tell at this distance?"
"I can't, no," Jamie said frankly. "But Innes and MacLeod can, and they say it's the blood-sucking English right enough. They'll have guessed our heading, maybe, and come after us as soon as they'd dealt with those poor black buggers on Hispaniola."
He turned away from the rail, shrugging.
"Damned little to be done about it, save to hope we stay ahead of them. Innes says there's a hope of giving them the slip off Cat Island if we reach there by dark."
As the day wore on, we kept just out of firing distance, but Innes looked more and more worried. The sea between Cat Island and Eleuthera was shallow and filled with coral heads. A man of war could never follow us into the maze, but neither could we move swiftly enough through it to avoid being sunk by the Porpoise's long guns. Once in those treacherous shoals and channels, we would be sitting ducks. At last, reluctantly, the decision was made to head east, out to sea. We couldn't risk slowing, and there was a slight chance of giving the man-o'-war the slip in the dark. When dawn came, all sight of land had disappeared. The Porpoise, unfortunately, had not. She was no closer, but as the wind rose along with the sun, she shook out more sail and began to gain. With every scrap of sail already hoisted, and nowhere to hide, there was nothing we could do but run and wait. All through the long hours of the morning, the Porpoise grew steadily larger astern. The sky had begun to cloud over, and the wind had risen considerably, but this helped the Porpoise, with her huge spread of canvas, a great deal more than it did us. By 10 o'clock, she was close enough to risk a shot. It fell far astern, but was frightening nonetheless. Innes squinted back over his shoulder, judging the distance, then shook his head and settled grimly to his course. There was nothing to be gained by tacking now. We must head straight on, as long as we could, taking evasive action only when it was too late for anything else. By 11, the porpoise had drawn within a quarter mile, and the monotonous boom of our forward guns had begun to sound every 10 minutes as our gunner tried the range. If I closed my eyes, I could imagine Erik Johansson bent sweating and powder-stained over his gun, the smoking slow match in his hand. I hoped that Anarchy had been left on Antigua with her goats. By 11:30 it had begun to rain, and a heavy sea was running. A sudden gust of wind struck us sideways, and the boat heeled over far enough to bring the port rail within a foot of the water. Dumped onto the deck by the motion, we disentangled ourselves as Innes and MacLeod skilfully righted the pinnace. I glanced back, as I did every few minutes, despite myself, and saw the seamen scampering aloft in the porpoise, reefing the topsails.
"That's luck!" MacGregor shouted in my ear, nodding where I was looking. "That'll slow them!"
By 12:30, the sky had gone a peculiar purple-green, and the wind had risen to an eerie whine. The porpoise had taken in yet more canvas, and in spite of the action, had had a staysail carried away, the scrap of canvas jerked from the mast and whipped away, flapping like an albatross. She had long since stopped firing on us, unable to aim at such a small target in the heavy swell. With the sun gone from sight, I could no longer estimate time. The storm caught us squarely, perhaps an hour later. There was no possibility of hearing anything. By sign language and grimaces, Innes made the men lower the sails. To keep canvas flying or even reefed was to risk having the mast ripped from the floorboards. I clung tight to the rail with one hand, to Ian's hand with the other. Jamie crouched behind us, arms spread to give us the shelter of his back. The rain lashed past, hard enough to sting the skin, driven almost horizontal by the wind, and so thick that I barely saw the faint shape on the horizon that I thought was Eleuthera. The sea had risen to terrifying heights, with swells rolling 40 feet high. The pinnace rowed them lightly, carried up and up and up to dizzy heights, then dropped abruptly into a trough. Jamie's face was dead white in the stormlight, his sodden hair pasted against his scalp. It was near dark that it happened. The sky was nearly black, but there was an eerie green glow all across the horizon that silhouetted the skeletal shape of the porpoise behind us. Another of the rain squalls slammed us sideways, lurching and swaying atop a huge wave. As we picked ourselves up from yet another bruising spill, Jamie grabbed my arm and pointed behind us. The porpoise's foremast was oddly bent, the top of it leaning far to one side. Before I had time to realise what was happening, the top 15 feet of the mast had split off and pitched into the sea, carrying with it rigging and spars. The man-o'-war swung heavily round this impromptu anchor and came sliding sideways down the face of a wave. The wall of water towered over the ship and came crashing down, catching her broadside. The porpoise heeled, spun around once. The next wave rose and took her stern first, pulling the high aft deck below the water, whipping the mast through the air like snapping twigs. It took 3 more waves to sink her. No time for escape for her hapless crew, but plenty for those of us watching to share their terror. There was a great bubbling flurry in the trough of a wave, and the man of war was gone. Jamie's arm was rigid as iron beneath my hand. All the men stared back, faces gone empty with horror. All save Innes, who crouched doggedly over the wheel, meeting each wave as it came. A new wave rose up beside the rail and seemed to hover there, looming above me. The great wall of water was glassy clear. I could see, suspended in it, the debris and the men of the wrecked porpoise, limbs outflung in grotesque ballet. The body of Thomas Leonard hung no more than 10 feet from me, drowned mouth open in surprise, his long soft hair a swirl above the gilded collar of his coat. Then the wave struck. I was snatched off the deck and at once engulfed in chaos. Blind and deaf, unable to breathe, I was tumbled through space, my arms and legs wrenched awry by the force of the water. Everything was dark. There was nothing but sensation, and all of that intense but indistinguishable. Pressure and noise and overwhelming cold. I couldn't feel the pull of my clothing or the jerk of the rope, if it was still there, around my waist. A sudden faint warmth swathed my legs, distinct in the surrounding cold as a cloud in a clear sky. Urine, I thought, but didn't know whether it was my own or the last touch of another human body, swallowed as I was in the belly of the wave. My head hit something with a sickening crack, and suddenly I was coughing my lungs out on the deck of the pinnace, still miraculously afloat. I sat up slowly, choking and wheezing. My rope was still in place, yanked so tight about my waist that I was sure my lower ribs were broken. I jerked feebly at it, trying to breathe. And then Jamie was there, one arm around me, the other groping at his belt for a knife.
"Are ye all right?" he bellowed,
his voice barely audible above the shrieking wind.
"No."
I tried to shout back, but it came out as no more than a wheeze. I shook my head, fumbling at my waist. The sky was a queer purple-green, a colour I'd never seen before. Jamie sawed at the rope, his bent head spray-soaked and the colour of mahogany, hair whipped across his face by the fury of the wind. The rope popped, and I gulped in air, ignoring a stabbing pain in my side and the stinging of raw skin about my waist. The ship was pitching wildly, the deck swinging up and down like a lawn glider. Jamie fell down on the deck, pulling me with him, and began to work his way on hands and knees toward the mast some 6 feet away, dragging me. My garments had been drenched through, plastered to me from my immersion in the wave. Now the blast of wind was so great that it plucked my skirts away from my legs and flung them up, half-dried, to beat about my face like goose wings. Jamie's arm was tight as an iron bar across my chest. I clung to him, trying to aid our progress by shoving with my feet on the slippery deck boards. Smaller waves washed over the rail, sousing us intermittently, but no more huge monsters followed them. Reaching hands grasped us and hauled us the last few feet into the nominal shelter of the mast. Innes had tied the wheel over long since. As I looked forward, I saw lightning strike the sea ahead, making the spokes of the wheel spring out black, leaving an image like a spider's web printed on my retina. Speech was impossible and unnecessary. Rayburn, Ian, Meldrum and Lawrence were huddled against the mast, all tied. Frightful as it was on deck, no one wanted to go below, to be tossed to and fro in bruising darkness with no notion of what was happening overhead. I was sitting on the deck, legs splayed, with the mast at my back and the line passed across my chest. The sky had gone lead-grey on one side, a deep lucent green on the other, and lightning was striking at random over the surface of the sea, bright jags of brilliance across the dark. The wind was so loud that even the thunderclaps reached us only now and then as muffled booms, like ships' guns firing at a distance. Then a bolt crashed down beside the ship, lightning and thunder together, close enough to hear the hiss of boiling water in the ringing aftermath of the thunderclap. The sharp reek of ozone flooded the air. Innes turned from the light, his tall, thin figure so sharply cut against the flash that he looked momentarily like a skeleton, black bones against the sky. The momentary dazzle and his movement made it seem for an instant that he stood whole once more, two arms swinging, as though his missing limb had emerged from the ghost world to join him, here, on the brink of eternity.
"Hold a head bone connected to the neck bone,"
Joe Abernathy's voice sang softly in memory.
"And the neck bone connected to the backbone."
I had a sudden, hideous vision of the scattered limbs I had seen on the beach by the corpse of the Brucha, animated by the lightning, squirming and wriggling to reunite.
"Them bones are gonna Walk around now, hear the word of the Lord.
Another clap of thunder, and I screamed, not at the sound, but at the lightning bolt of memory. A skull in my hands with empty eyes that had once been the green of the hurricane sky.
Jamie shouted something in my ear, but I couldn't hear him. I could only shake my head in speechless shock, my skin rippling with horror.
My hair, like my skirts, was drying in the wind. The strands of it danced on my head, pulling at the roots.
As it dried, I felt the crackle of static electricity where my hair brushed my cheek.
There was a sudden movement among the sailors around me, and I looked up to see the spars and rigging above coated in the blue phosphorescence of St. Elmo's fire.
A fireball dropped to the deck and rolled towards us, streaming phosphorescence. Jamie struck at it, and it hopped delicately into the air and rolled away along the rail, leaving a scent of burning in its wake.
I looked up at Jamie to see if he was all right, and saw the loose ends of his hair standing out from his head, coated with fire and streaming backward like a demon's.
Streaks of vivid blue outlined the fingers of his hand when he brushed the hair from his face.
Then he looked down, saw me, and grasped my hand.
A jolt of electricity shot through us both with the touch. But he didn't let go.
I couldn't say how long it lasted, hours or days.
Our mouths dried from the wind and grew sticky with thirst. The sky went from grey to black, but there was no telling whether it was night or only the coming of rain. The rain, when it did come, was welcome. It came with the drenching roar of a tropical shower, a drumming audible even above the wind. Better yet, it was hail, not rain. The hailstones hit my skull like pebbles, but I didn't care. I gathered the icy globules in both hands and swallowed them half-melted, a cool benison to my tortured throat. Meldrum and MacLeod crawled about the deck on hands and knees, scooping the hailstones into buckets and pots, anything that would hold water. I slept intermittently, head lolling on Jamie's shoulder, and woke to find the wind still screaming. Numb to terror now, I only waited. Whether we lived or died seemed of little consequence, if only the dreadful noise would stop. There was no telling day from night, no way to keep time while the sun hid its face. The darkness seemed a little lighter now and then, but whether it was by virtue of daylight or moonlight, I couldn't tell. I slept and woke and slept again. Then I woke to find the wind a little quieter. The seas still heaved, and the tiny boat pitched like a cockle shell, throwing us up and dropping us with stomach-churning regularity. But the noise was less. I could hear when MacGregor shouted to Ian to pass a cup of water. The men's faces were chapped and raw, their lips cracked to bleeding by the whistling wind, but they were smiling.
"It's gone by."
Jamie's voice was low and husky in my ear, rusted by weather. "The storm's passed."
It was. There were breaks in the lead-grey sky and small flashes of a pale, fresh blue. I thought it must be early morning, sometime just past dawn, but couldn't tell for sure. While the hurricane had ceased to blow, there was still a strong wind, and the storm surge carried us at an amazing speed. Meldrum took the wheel from Innes, and bending to check the compass, gave a cry of surprise. The fireball that had come aboard during the storm had harmed no one, but the compass was now a melted mass of silver metal, the wooden casing around it untouched.
"Amazing," said Lawrence, touching it reverently with one finger. "Aye, and inconvenient forby," said Innes dryly.
He looked upward toward the ragged remnants of the dashing clouds.
"Much of a hand at celestial navigation, are you, Mr. Stern?"
After much squinting at the rising sun and the remnants of the morning stars, Jamie, Innes, and Stern determined that our heading was roughly northeast.
"We must turn to the west," Stern said, leaning over the crude chart with Jamie and Innes.
We do not know where we are, but any land must surely be to the west.
Innes nodded, peering soberly at the chart, which showed a sprinkle of islands like coarse ground pepper floating on the waters of the Caribbean.
Aye, that's so, he said. We've been headed out to sea for good news.